Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Nearly 4 years ago, as they were defeating the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for their port, activists in Tacoma found out that a large liquid natural gas distribution hub and storage facility was also being planned at the port. Once they defeated the methanol refinery, which shifted its sights to Clamor, Washington, where it's still being fought, Tacoma activists refocused on stopping the LNG project. 4 years later, after zigzagging through many public hearings and protests, the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency recently announced that they've approved the facility's clean air permit, so now construction can begin. Except that an 8-million-gallon LNG storage tank, which started being built before the air permit was even approved, is nearly finished. But despite the Clean Air Agency's decision to go ahead and allow the project to move forward, LNG opponents are not giving up. Today we talk with Claudia Riedner, a ceramic artist and co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, about the continuing fight to stop the LNG facility. Claudia, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Barbara. Hello, Portland.
Good morning. Well, a few weeks ago, there was a lot of good news throughout the Northwest, or at least promising news, as Peter DeFazio came out against Jordan Cove and the Department of Ecology in Washington decided to write its own environmental impact statement for the methanol refinery proposed for Calama. But amidst that good news was news that the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency was going ahead and issuing the permit for this LNG facility that you've been fighting for a really long time. So I'm kind of curious about how that feels being in Tacoma, where it's looking more promising for other parts of the region, but there in Tacoma, you're still fighting one more fossil fuel project.
Well, we definitely feel like we have a giant target on our backs, and we feel like that our politicians are enabling more pollution rather than standing up for a better climate for future generations, for all of us.
What are some of your biggest concerns about the LNG facility?
So immediate concerns, of course, are that this would be holding the equivalent of 166 kilotons of TNT, and that's in the heart of the second largest city on the Puget Sound. So risks beyond the facility have never even been looked at or contemplated. PSC and the city continue to say that no ill effects would be able to go beyond the fence line of this facility. Yet in Washington, we already know that at Plymouth LNG in 2014, that a relatively small explosion did harm way beyond the fence line of the facility. So risks as far as explosions and fires have not been analyzed, and there are greenhouse gas issues, there are siting issues with it being sited on Medicine Creek Treaty territory. There's issues with politicians having taken Puget Sound Energy money and then turned around and decided in their favor. So the list of issues is pretty long, and unfortunately the list keeps growing the longer we look at it.
Well, again, it's also the climate change issues. And one of the contentious concerns around this approved permit was that at one point, Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, after, I guess, being, I don't actually remember if this was they did this on their own or they were being sued to do this, but they required that Puget Sound Energy, who's a company building the facility, had to redo their environmental impact statement to include the life cycle analysis of greenhouse gases from the fracking fields all the way to Tacoma. And there were some issues with that supplementary environmental impact statement. What were some of the issues that really concerned you?
Some of the major flaws that are really, I feel, unsurmountable by the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency are that they did a climate harm assumption of methane. They spread out over 100 years. And over 100 years, methane has about a 25-fold worse impact than CO2 on our climate. But if you look at real-term, short-term analysis of methane over 20 years, it actually makes climate 85 times worse than even CO2. And given that the facility only is supposed to have a lifespan of 40 years, it makes absolutely no sense that the Clean Air Agency assumed 100, stretched out the pollution basically over 100 years.
And then there's
another
also
major.
Yeah, go on.
Sorry?
Yeah, continue.
Another major flaw is that the Clean Air Agency themselves admitted that they did not use best available science, and that's in the greenhouse gas analysis. So instead, they're they're taking numbers from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, their self-declared methane leakage rate in Canada, and that's what they based all their assumptions on. And of course, by now, even Canadian institutions are looking at this and say that actually it's at least two or three times worse than the Clean Air Agency assumed.
So after all these comments were put in to comment on the inaccuracies, the lack of factuality about this environmental impact statement, they went through the whole period of listening to your concerns, and then they issued a final supplemental environmental impact statement. And was there any difference between the final one? Did they take any of your concerns into consideration?
No, I believe there were 15 or 20,000 comments, and many of those comments came from scientists, from climate scientists. They came from chemists, and they even came from the Department of Ecology and even the Attorney General's office. They made a comment and said that this analysis is fictional. And despite all of this, all of these questions and public comment and comment from other institutions, PSCA basically did not change their draft and approved it as a final.
Well, one of the things that was really concerning, I was up in Tacoma back at the end of August when PSCA had, and PSCA we're referring to as the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, for those people who aren't in the know of acronyms, and they were having their final comment period for over a day at the end of August. But I think it was about a week or 2 weeks before they were listening to comments in person and also accepting comments by mail and by email. They basically came out and said that they were going to approve the permit. Isn't that? It seemed to be a little bit premature to make that kind of decision.
I feel that it was a predetermined outcome. They said as much. They said they will approve this notice of construction permit, mind you, even though the facility is already built. Finally, they said they would approve the notice of construction permit, and that's before they held a public hearing. That's before they accepted public comment. So I'm not sure why they went through the motion, why they expended so much staff time, so much of the public's time, to pretend to listen when clearly they had already made up their mind.
Well, there's two parts to it. One is, it seems to me that violates all kinds of legalities. I think in the public process, there you have to listen to all the comments before you make a decision. At least not come out and say that you've made your decision before you further comments. The other part that really struck me was that at that hearing, it was a very emotional hearing, and I remember particularly this climate scientist from Seattle, Heather Price, who I learned at the hearing, her family lives in Tacoma, and she talked about how her family and her family synagogue were going to be in the blast zone. But she gave this really emotional appeal to PSCA, and other people did the same thing too, to this panel. But it was a sort of this recognition that the few people that were sitting in the panel on the stage were not the decision makers. And one point where it really got me was one guy was telling them, he said, we know that you're kind of, being controlled, and it was kind of like the Matrix. And he said, just blink once if you understand what our point is. And I mean, to me, it was a very emotional, very disturbing experience, because it could feel like people had come to the end of what they saw as their legal opportunities to really have a voice in this decision that was going to affect their lives in major ways. And I wonder, after the aftermath of that, how did people feel once that hearing happened and you knew that the inevitable was going to happen?
Well, it was pretty shocking. And since you're speaking of that meeting, our state senator, Chini Daniel, showed up to the meeting. And she made several really important points. And one of the points that she made was that for that final public hearing from the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, only staff was present. And from what we understand is that staff had recommended to the board of the agency to not be in appearance. But that's in direct violation of the Washington State Clean Air Act that stipulates that these permits have to be approved by the board of the Clean Air Agency and not by staff. And yet in several meetings, the director Kenworthy of the Clean Air Agency, he said that board had nothing to do with these decisions and it was staff decisions. So they themselves have admitted that they're in indirect violation of the state Clean Air Act. And perhaps the reason why they try to separate the board from the decisions is because when you look at the Washington State Public Disclosure Commission webpage, you can see that every single one of the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency board has been financed over the years by the applicant, which is Puget Sound Energy. So we see very direct conflicts of interest, and as a result, we see them violating the law, and that's pretty disturbing.
Well, I guess a question, I mean, not that this is so much of an anomaly, because I think probably we dug deeply into what goes on in Oregon. It might not be a whole lot more encouraging, but it seemed like it's beyond what I'm familiar with in terms of the government agencies doing things that are deceptive and violate the law. Is there something about Tacoma that encourages, or maybe not just Tacoma, but the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency itself, that encourages this kind of deception and this kind of nepotism?
I think it does, and that's because it's actually not acting under the state. It's its own agency. So it's run by local politicians. Really, that's who makes up the board. It's the political leaders of the four county region, and so that makes quite a difference compared to, let's say, a state agency that has, you know, different staff and just has a different governing function altogether. And we notice this, for example, when we look at what the Washington State Department of Ecology just did with the Kalama methanol study on greenhouse gases. And they basically told the methanol organization or the methanol company, Northwest Innovation Works, they told them to go back to the drawing board and revise their emissions and use best available science and use real analysis. And before they approved the greenhouse gas supplemental analysis. But here with the Clean Air Agency, we see that they had done no such thing. And so they're actually acting very different compared to ecology. And for us people here in Tacoma, or in fact everybody living in this four county region, we are not treated the same way under the law as ecology would. And so it's sad that our local board would be much weaker than the state agency, and that seems to be a question of equity as well.
Well, actually, we read some of the press releases that came out right after the Department of Ecology announced that they were not going to accept the supplemental environmental impact statement that the Port of Kalama and Cowlitz County had written for the methanol refinery. And what was curious to me was that both the entities, well, Northwest Innovation Works, who's the company building the methanol refinery, and the county and the port all said, there's nothing wrong with our environmental impact statement. We stand behind it. It's, you know, the best science. It's totally transparent. And so then the Department of Ecology said, well, then we're going to write it ourselves. And that's where it stands now. So they've taken the authority away from the entities that were in charge, and now it's at the state level that the environmental impact statement will be written. And I'm hopeful that this means that the ecology department will follow the requirements that they were trying to get the county and the port to follow, and that the methanol refinery will be shown to be a great greenhouse emitter, and that'll be the end of it. What do you have to do at your end? I mean, is there a way, for instance, for you to get the Department of Ecology to take over being the lead agency for the LNG plant?
So after Governor Inslee has come out saying that he cannot in good conscience support either the methanol refinery nor the liquefied gas refinery here in Tacoma, the mayor of Tacoma wrote a letter, and she said that basically if the state feels like the city did not do an adequate job in their analysis of safety, health, climate impacts of this facility, that they should take back the lead agency. And so I am not really sure who would be in charge to actually take in the reins of this boondoggle of a permitting process and fix it and clean it up so that the public can continue to have trust in our public agencies. So I'm not sure if that actually falls on ecology or if it falls on the city of Tacoma, or if it actually would have to be triggered by a lawsuit.
We're going to get to that in a moment, but you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Claudia Riedner, who's co-founder of Redefine Tacoma. We're talking about the continuing fight to stop the Tacoma LNG facility. Well, speaking of lawsuits, right after the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency made their announcement that they were going to go ahead and issue the permit to build this tank that's already mostly built, and I guess the rest of the facility as well, you had a press conference up in Tacoma, and a bunch of people spoke and made statements. And your statement in the press release was that everybody should file an appeal. Everybody who made a comment legally can file an appeal, and they should do that. But what has actually turned out in the last week?
So the Clean Air Agency sent notice of approval of the notice of construction on December the 10th, and they actually managed to sandwich this between the morning's climate emergency declaration of the Puyallup tribe, and the same day in the evening, the city of Tacoma as well declared a climate emergency. So after this, we did have a press conference, and to me at that time, it felt like that everybody who has spent their time reading through all these analysis and reading the draft analysis both on greenhouse gas and on other issues. And if they have made comments and those comments were not properly answered, I felt like this was grounds to appeal for every person who felt like their questions were not taken into consideration. But in the meantime, what we've learned is that the Puyallup tribe, on one hand, and also a group of local environmental groups, including Earth Justice Act, which is Advocates for Cleaner Tacoma, the Sierra Club, the Washington Environmental Council, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Stand Earth had jointly filed an appeal to this Clean Air Agency decision to give notice of construction permit to the LNG refinery. And because of these appeals and with other conversations we've had over the last few weeks, it really seems that it's much smarter to let these appeals go forward and not clutter the whole process with a whole bunch of people appealing. So that's the consensus we are at right now. So we are trusting in the tribe, and we're trusting in these environmental organizations that those appeals will have teeth and will be looked at properly by our agencies.
Well, the last time that we talked, you mentioned that there were two ways to appeal. I mean, one is that there was a free, simple way any citizen could appeal, a 30-day process to, I don't remember what agency it is, but under PSCA. But then there's the lawsuits that are actually going through sound like that's a different kind of appeal than the one that you were talking about.
So at this point, what has been filed by both the tribe and those environmental organizations I just listed is an appeal of this permit. And when you go to it's called the Pollution Control Board of Appeals. And so that's not unlike the Utility and Transportation Commission. That's a three-member panel that's appointed by the governor of Washington State. So this board will be hearing the appeals and decide within an appropriate time frame whether they're going to let the appeal go forth or not. And so while their instructions on their own webpage say that anybody can appeal and that you don't need a lawyer and it doesn't cost anything to appeal, when you actually call the board, you realize that it's not a board that is either used to deal with the public or, frankly, interested in dealing with the public. For example, when I call them and I ask a simple question like, what do the 30 days mean? Do they include, is it calendar days? Is it business days? And basically they said legally they are not able to reply to any questions from the public. So even a very basic question is, what's the final date of the appeal? They would not answer. So at this point, I really feel like it's better to leave it to organizations and the tribe to follow through with the appeal.
So is it going to be like an expensive deal with, I mean, obviously the tribes and Earth Justice have legal legal facilities so that they can deal with all the things that a common citizen couldn't do. But is it going to turn out that it's a very involved legal process to do this appeal?
I'm not really sure the appeal is all that involved or all that expensive. And as I said, there is not really a fee involved with it. But nobody believes that it's gonna end at these appeals. There will be actual lawsuits filed as well. So that's just a matter of looking at it when it happens in the future.
Well, that answers my next question, which is what happens after the appeals. So meanwhile, can Puget Sound Energy start building while these appeals are going on?
So that's another big question, and when the Clean Air Agency Board actually told Puget Sound Energy that they are building under their own risk, because they have been building without the main permit up until December the 10th when the permit got approved. So there should be fines levied, and that's what the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency said they would do, but so far we haven't heard a word about what kind of fines would be levied. And at this point, we know that Puget Sound Energy basically got away with building without permits, and nobody else will get away other than big industry, which is another disappointing fact we learned.
So I'm kind of wondering what the state of mind is up there. I mean, you were pretty happy, it seemed, after hearing about the lawsuits or the appeals being filed last week. But you've been slogging through this for, well, including methanol. It's been, what is it like? It's 5 years that you've been fighting this stuff now. And I just wonder how you're kind of seeing towards the future and what your game plan is, or if you find any respite from all of this.
Well, the beautiful part about looking at all this is that we've made lots and lots of friends along the way, and we've built amazing coalitions. And for example, there are over 60 environmental groups that have actively opposed this LNG refinery, and they have written statements of opposition. And so I feel like the community very much has galvanized around the reality of climate. They have galvanized around the reality that Tacoma is a frontline community. And I also believe that the community is really realizing the amazing asset that we have with the Puyallup tribe. And as we know, the world over, that areas that are controlled by indigenous people have much higher biodiversity, they have a much more cared for environment, and they have better diversity. And so I feel like the Puyallup tribe has stepped forward in a beautiful leadership position. And so those are the things that make me very hopeful, to see the community is more together, and they're more willing to fight all these things. And then also what gives me hope is the youth movement that has managed to even get the city of Tacoma to declare a climate emergency. Now, of course, that climate emergency doesn't really have, many actual points that are going to do much of anything in the near future, but it's still a good beginning, and now we have a tool that we can hold the council responsible for in the future.
Well, getting back to the tribe, I wonder, what is the Puyallup tribe's exact stake in all of this fight? Why, just beside being an indigenous people that are living in this area which has been destroyed over the last 150 years, but beside that, what is their really specific stake in this particular piece of land?
Well, so as we know, as it happened all around this country, is that indigenous people, tribes were moved away from their homeland. They were pushed in territory that was deemed to be undesirable by settlers and by colonialists, and so the Puyallup tribe ended up with a reservation that basically encompasses the entire port of Tacoma. So after this reservation was formed and deemed to be the homeland of the Puyallup tribe, all these entities, when they realized that the port was a good tool for shipping and for industry, and that it was, a deep water port, industry moved in, and within a span of 100 years, they basically permanently polluted much of this once really fertile tidal lands. But so the Puyallup tribe's reservation still encompasses the entire port. And then as you look at the situation where the LNG refinery has been built already, that's a piece of land that was created via fill from a sarco slag, like toxic slag from the copper smelter that used to be in Tacoma, mixed with dredgings from the Puyallup River when they diverted the river into a different bed. And so that land not only is, of course, really hazardous in earthquakes because it's, you know, prone to liquefaction, but it's also created out of the treaty-enshrined areas where the legal rights of the tribe apply as it goes to fishing and hunting and gathering.
Because this used to be tideland. I mean, it was underwater a lot of the time, right?
Exactly. Most of the time, this would be underwater, and it was only a tiny little area that would not be flooded regularly. So the tidelands were what was the Puyallup's main food source for ocean proteins, shellfish, salmon, and all these things the Medicine Creek Treaty is enshrined in the Constitution. It's called the Land of the Law. So it is just as strong as the Constitution. And it really needs to be upheld. And by having allowed these usual and accustomed places to hunt, fish, and gather, to having those being dumped upon and turned into industry, is definitely a violation of the treaty in not just in the spirit, but in the actual wording of the treaty.
So how does the port get around that? I know that there was a land claim settlement a number of years ago, and the port people claim that the Indians got a really good deal, and the Indians say, no, we didn't get a very good deal. So how do these two different visions of who owns the land, who has the right to do whatever they want with it, how does that get resolved?
So the land claim settlement does claim to have put all these issues to rest, but clearly that's not the case at all, and we know it's not the case at all because during the construction of this refinery, there have been several instances when people went onto the site and they chained themselves, tied themselves onto equipment to stop the building of this, you know, conceived illegally built refinery. And in the court cases, neither the Port of Tacoma nor the City of Tacoma were able to provide a proper deed to the land, like an original warranty deed or anything like that. And so because of that, the people that were accused of trespassing were actually found not guilty on all accounts because the legality of who actually owns that piece of land is still not being proven.
So one of the things that really impresses me when I'm up in Tacoma and watching the movement that's galvanized around LNG is the strength of having leadership from the Puyallup tribe. And I'm wondering if you can talk about what you've learned in the time that you've spent in contact with the tribe and learned both, like, I guess, on, kind of like on a human spiritual level and also on a political legal level. And maybe also on a political level of how to take leadership in a fight like this.
So we've been watching a beautiful development over the last few years, and it really originated with the Water Warriors. And the Water Warriors are a group of Puyallup tribal members that have taken it upon themselves to show up and speak up and to let the city of Tacoma know that they have rights and these rights are being violated as we speak. And because of their continued presence, for example, the Dakota case was asking the city to finally fly the Puyallup flag in city chambers. And it took a few years, but the city finally accepted that. And they've also finally accepted to recognize that the Puyallup Tribal Council, they're actually a sovereign nation. They're not just like another city council or another board. They're their own sovereign nation. And so finally, I feel like they're seriously treated with respect. They're given allowance, time to speak that's not being buzzed off by a two-minute time limit at public hearings and whatnot. So that has been really beautiful to watch. And the tribe is steadfast in their own commitment to the environment. they're phasing out fossil fuel engines by 2035, and that includes vehicles and buildings and includes marine operations. So I feel like they're really putting literally the money where their mouth is at, and so that's been really amazing. And personally, for me personal, what I have learned is that I'm a transplant. I moved here from Europe, and even though I've been here for 20 years, at the beginning when I lived in Tacoma, I was not even really absolutely aware that there was a living, thriving tribe right within the city. So I learned that, and I also learned I don't have kids. I don't have relatives. My stake in the future is really in a way limited to my own personal life. And so what I have learned from the tribe is that their strong belief that we have to live and act for seven generations into the future. And also that the tribe really, we can all move. I mean, you know how many Americans move around, how many people just move away for a job or for family, or they just like to live in a different place. And the Puyallup tribe has nowhere to go. They're here. That's their homeland. That's their country, really. And so to start looking at the world with the idea that you're here and this is where you stay and this is where you fight for a better environment, and the whole idea that you are concerned with how people in seven generations will have to deal with the situation, and also that they're a voice for those who can't speak up. They're a strong voice, an emotional voice for salmon, for orca, for basically anything that lives that is not a human being. And those rights need to be recognized for the survival of our own species. And I think that the tribe's really beautifully recognizing that and making it shown to the rest of us.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Claudia Riedner, who's co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, about the continuing fight to stop the Tacoma LNG facility. One of the things that I just learned recently in the work that I've been doing about all the fossil fuel problems around the Northwest is that the tribes consider that we are in the seventh generation, which is the seventh generation from the time when the treaties were signed back in the 19th century. And that the prophecies say that the seventh generation is when, depending on your take, either when things will turn around and become the way they should be again and be rebalanced, or, as I heard Dakota Case and a couple other people say in Tacoma back in the end of August, if things aren't turned around, it's going to be too late. It's all over. I wonder how that vision also inflects the movement that you have in the coalition that you have with the Puyallup tribe.
It's definitely very difficult to realize that the salmon runs are not happening anymore. It's difficult to realize that even in Alaska, cod fishery had to be halted for the first time, and that we are losing life in our ocean. So it is, and I live with this daily as well, to where you feel like it's all hopeless and it's just time to give up and live your life as best you can. Or, you know, do you continue fighting, and what's the best way to stand up and to fight? And what's the best way to stand up and to fight? There are a million answers to that question. And so we all, I believe, just need to do what it is in our capability and capacity and in our interest to do so. And I also believe it's extremely important that we don't burden all this on the shoulders of young people, to basically say, hey, we're giving up, it's hopeless, and you know, good luck with your life. I feel like we need to, just like we're supporting the Puyallup tribe, we also support youth movement. The Sunrise Movement has been extremely instrumental, and it's really been the Sunrise Movement in Washington that has forced the city of Tacoma into declaring a climate emergency.
Actually, I want to get back
So it's hopeful. Go ahead.
Well, I just had this image. I was watching the video of the day that climate emergency was declared, and I have two very strong images, and one is one of the young people who was making statements who just burst into tears. And every time I am around young people who are talking about the climate emergency, and you see the urgency that they feel, which is so much more intense than as much intensity as people our age feel about it, when the next 50 years of your life could be underwater, so to speak, I think it's much that much more intense. But the other thing juxtaposed with that was the expression of your mayor when she's making the statement about declaring the climate emergency. And I was thinking, I saw this expression where I felt like, she really does get this. I mean, why? And then on the other hand, she supports Michael Bloomberg for the Democratic primary for presidential candidate. So I just was thinking about those two contradictions, the young woman who is completely, completely intensely involved in understanding the issues, and your mayor who has this very strange schizophrenic split around the whole thing, and how that helps your city or hurts your city from functioning.
I think this kind of duplicity kind of carries through with many of the agencies. It's not just the city of Tacoma. And so when you look at our politicians, it's pretty clear that the city of Tacoma political position leads to wanting to run for the state or federally. It's a step on the ladder up in a political career. And I think many people that run for city council have decided that their life will be a political career. And so they have to play along with the chamber and the port and other politicians. And they have to allow industry, like laissez-faire, it's the neoliberal idea to let industry deal as it wishes, because they're our job creators. So I don't think our politicians dare to interfere with this. But they also emotionally realize that what they're doing by burdening youth with all the climate work, and they also realize that the facts are real and science is real. These people are not stupid. They're very well engaged with the world. And we kind of see the same split in personality, if you want to call it that, with people, with staff at the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. They know this is wrong. They know we can't pollute anymore. They know we can't burn any more fossil fuels. But yet they're bound by policies written by politicians who are funded by the industry. So I think the funding cycle really is a big one that we need to look at and that we need to break. We need to break the addiction to fossil fuel money, you know, in all levels, especially in politics.
Oh, and talking about the cycle of money, there was an article in the Seattle Times yesterday. Don Steinke, who's a strong climate activist in Vancouver, Washington, posted it on Facebook. So I want to appreciate Don for alerting me to this. Anyway, this is the article starts by saying, Washington and Oregon natural gas companies, rattled by local proposals that could shift more buildings to electricity, will spend $1 million on a public relations campaign to promote their fuel as part of the region's clean energy future. The gas companies are forming a coalition of unions, businesses, and consumer groups to tout the benefits of natural gas and to help prevent or defeat initiatives that inhibit its use, according to internal industry and documents obtained by the Seattle Times. They're calling the coalition Partners for Energy Progress, and a public launch is scheduled next year. And then there's the guy who is heading the PR campaign, which is the same company that fought off... fallout of the cap and trade initiative that you had last year on the Washington ballot, and also I think fought the soda tax initiative and all kinds of things. And he talks about how right now the gas industry is facing an existential threat. So I wonder, did you see that article by any chance?
I have, and I read it, and it turns out that Puget Sound Energy and another gas company, they were hiring the firm Quinn Thomas to do all this work. It's specific in how they plan to go about it. They're literally trying to target suburbia females and make sure that those suburbia females want to continue to cook on gas. Because gas, you know, it's so much fun to have a blue flame in your kitchen, never mind that it actually increases your indoor air pollution to levels that would be illegal if it was outdoors, right? So we've seen this very same situation from Puget Sound Energy since the very beginning. And what they're doing is they're creating push polls that are frankly borderline racist towards the tribe, and they're creating push polls that are pushing certain politicians into power and into position. And they've, from what we understand, they've been spending about $90,000 a month just on promotion and advertising for more gas and for the supposedly clean LNG. And they, I mean, it becomes really ridiculous. I mean, they keep saying, for example, that this refinery would clean up Tacoma's air, when we know that there would be lead and mercury and formaldehyde and toluene and benzene. All these things would be pumped into our air, and these toxins are not even really regularly monitored. So the propaganda machine that Puget Sound Energy is running, and it's the same that tobacco industry did. It's the same that, you know, Exxon did, the oil industries did. They're desperately afraid of their industry being on their way out, and fracked gas, it's just it's not what people want anymore because they know what's going on.
Well, it seems that this campaign, the Partners for Energy Progress, is actually an escalation of what they've been doing both up your way and also down in Southern Oregon with all the, as my friend Larry Mannion calls, the giant Hallmark cards they get from Jordan Cove all the time. One of the lines, this guy, John Swatowski, who's from the company that's doing this campaign.
PR firm?
Yeah, and he says that natural gas, he says, is under an existential threat that is sustained and will only become more acute. And then the tagline for the campaign is, "Want to keep your gas stove? Join us." So it sounds like they're, I mean, and that's an interesting kernel because I have arguments with friends about, you know, I mean, I cook with gas too, and sure, gas is great to cook with. But there are, you know, it's like at some point we have to rethink all the things that we are, you know, comfortable with that are also really, really bad for the planet and also bad for ourselves. And one of the, I mean, I've been having a lot of discussions with like the furnace guy and the stove repair guy and talking about my concerns about gas. And some of them are like agreeing with me that, yeah, gas is on its way out, and other ones are really defending it. And I think that that's where we really have to, like, it's a new line to be crossed, is getting people to understand that the things that we consider to be our comforts and the old concept that natural gas is a clean energy, we have to be able to counter that. And it seems like Puget Sound Energy is really found that soft point where we might have a very hard time making that convincing argument.
I'm not even sure we have to necessarily make a different argument, because the argument will be economical. And as we see already, is that heat pumps are becoming more efficient, and they're becoming more affordable to install. And once they're installed, they're a lot more affordable to run. And so I think over time, as more and more efforts go towards truly sustainable and truly renewable ways to move ourselves about and to heat our homes, natural gas, it's on its way out. I mean, it hasn't made a profit for investors. The gas prices are tanking. They tanked 50% over 52 weeks because the hideous glut, because everybody's just pumping as much as they possibly can. And so it's so hideously unsustainable, and we have seen that industry is not willing to control themselves one bit or to throttle themselves one bit. And so I think the consumers are naturally going to go towards those solutions that will save them money over time, especially for new construction. It just makes no sense to hook yourself permanently to an outdated fossil fuel. It's more expensive in the long run, and it's also, frankly, very dangerous. I mean, houses and neighborhoods blow up all the time. Pipelines blow up all the time, and those risks are all rolled over to the community. The industry is not covering any of those risks. I mean, we learned that when a Canadian gas pipeline erupted, and it caused our gas rates to increase by 14%, which means now in our region we are responsible for out of the country gas infrastructure. And so people are realizing that, and over time the switch to electric has another amazing benefit, and that means you can actually also cool your house, and with heat events increasing everywhere, I'm sure people are looking at better options.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and we're talking today with Claudia Riedner, who's co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, We've been talking about the continuing fight to stop the Tacoma LNG facility, and we're also talking about the maybe continuing fight to change minds about the safety and the efficacy of natural, or what we should call, frack gas. Actually, every time I think about gas now, I think about this whole block in Northwest Portland that blew up a couple years ago when a worker hit a gas line and blew up the best bagel store in Portland and shattered the windows out of our acupuncturist office. I mean, it was really, really a shattering thing. And I guess there was also an incident like that in Seattle not that long ago. So I do think that it's like one of the things that we need to counter the arguments of the gas industry with are the fact that natural gas, while it might be really great to cook with, will also kill you, and that it's really good to have energy sources that don't blow up. But I do think that I'm a little bit concerned when I read the article in the Seattle Times that the gas industry is very slick, just like the tobacco industry, and that they could take years to fight off their kind of propaganda. So I wonder, what is your thought, besides the economic factors that you mentioned, to woo away those suburban housewives from their gas ranges?
Well, the only way to counteract propaganda is with speaking to the realities of it, and I'm hoping the state of Washington is really as committed as they say they are, and so therefore eventually, you know, communities like Bellingham or Berkeley already are not allowing new hookups, new gas hookups, and so eventually the state will have to do something. It'll be a simple reality, because what we should be doing right now and will be forced into doing before too long is, instead of incentivizing and subsidizing all this gas and all this oil, which we know is all subsidized to large proportions, that we need to take those monies and we need to build resiliencies. I mean, just 3 days ago, entire swaths of downtown Tacoma were completely impassable because the water was 3 feet in the roadway. The storm drains were shooting water up like water fountains. And so this costs money daily in all these communities. It's not just here, but it's flooded farmland, it's water restrictions, and all these things cost money, and we need to build resiliencies. And so even the gas and oil industry, my fight with, you know, dirty tricks and with false statements and with propaganda, the reality is that we will be having more severe consequences from climate every year.
Well, actually, I understand that 10% of Tacoma will be underwater at least definitely by the end of the century, but maybe sooner than that. And part of the area that's going to be underwater is where they're building that LNG tank.
Absolutely. The port of Tacoma is scheduled to be flooded by 2050. And those are City of Tacoma analysis. It's in their environmental action plan. They know this is coming. They know it's happening. So it's not just LNG out there. I mean, we have a massive, many, many million gallons of mixed petrochemical fuels at Targa, which is now called Port Terminal, which is literally a stone's throw away from the LNG. And it's situated right on the water. So all these facilities will have to be, you know, improved or removed, or they would, you know, expose the entire port to serious risk. So all this needs to be funded somehow, and it's really time to burden these costs on the industry that actually makes profits off of this. And we need to do this now because we know what's coming. I mean, why wait, right?
Well, and actually, the last thing I want to talk about is the lessons that the rest of us can learn from Tacoma. Because for many years, people in every other city on the west side of the Pacific Northwest, every other city but Tacoma, sort of looked down at Tacoma as just kind of this toxic waste dump, basically. You know, it's just like this place is just completely taken over by industry, and it's had the odor of Tacoma, the aroma of Tacoma, and all that kind of stuff. But what I've been seeing in Tacoma, as I've gotten to know the community much better, is it also has some of the fiercest climate activists in the region. And because you're on the front line, you really know what you're up against. And now Portland is discovering that it's a frontline community too, and we're fighting Zenith Oil. And I wonder what Portland activists can learn from those of you in Tacoma who've been fighting a what appears to be a much bigger problem. But in fact, as you noted the last time you were in Portland, that we have more fossil fuel storage tanks at the Port of Portland than you have at Targa. So we've got a real big problem also on a liquefaction zone. So what can we learn from you guys?
So what I find to be the most important part of all this work is to be hypervigilant and be extremely informed. And by hypervigilant, I mean you have to watch all these permitting agencies and all the lease signing authorities and make sure that, like, for example, the Port of Tacoma can sign a lease and the public has no idea. They signed a lease. They signed a 50-year lease for methanol without the public even really being informed about this. So what we have learned is that we need to comb through agendas and we need to look out for things that are happening in our community, because if you wait until the lease is signed and if you wait until some agency makes some kind of a basic environmental impact statement and then it moves ahead, that's when you run into trouble. That's when you really need to start working with lawyers and spend a lot more money. But if you can motivate the community to stand up at the beginning before any of these decisions are being made, that's exactly what happened with methanol. The company had to leave because thousands of people were not going to have any of this. And so they didn't even have a finished SEPA, an environmental impact statement of any sort, at that point. And so it's really important to get informed and to act early and to be aware of what's going on. And we find to, you know, disseminate this information to as broad a public as possible has been working really well. And we take advantage of social medias and emailing lists and things like that. So it's just really tedious and boring, and you need to read agendas and minutes. And nobody really wants to do it, but that's kind of a big key to the whole issue.
Well, when I first started taking on covering fossil fuel issues, the thing that really struck me is these people who are going to Port Commission meetings every month. Actually, in Vancouver, Washington, they're going twice a month. And that they were on first-name basis with all their port commissioners. And they would be reading all these public documents, and they'd be finding these little notices in the local newspapers. And just the amount of time and research it took to be able to track these things and stay on top of them really blew my mind. And I saw the same thing when I started spending time in Tacoma and seeing what you're doing. My first response was, like, how do you have the stamina to do this? And I guess so that's my first question. And then beyond that, how do you maybe transcend the kind of minute details and the minutiae that you are involved in all the time to get a much broader picture of where you're going?
Well, in the end, and I know that has been said on many, many times, in the end, everything is politics. And so we know that if you, and you know, Vancouver knows this really well, if you manage to elect good community-oriented and environmentally-oriented port commissioners, then the entire equation changes. And then the publicly owned lands at a port will actually be administered with the public in mind instead of solely to industry's benefit. And so here in Tacoma, it's taken a couple of election cycles, but this year, Kristen Ng got elected, and she's extremely forward-thinking, and she will be a bigger voice for the community inside the Port Commission. And hopefully next cycle we manage to get another one or two Port Commissioners in there, and pretty soon the situation will change. I mean, look at the Portland City Council and what they managed to do as far as excluding fossil fuel. And in Tacoma, we are not here yet, but eventually that's where it's going to have to go. And so what we can do is encourage young people to vote and sign them up, register them to vote. Those also kind of tedious steps will just have to get done in order for us to have a better voice in all of this.
Actually, what Portland has one disadvantage is our port commission is not elected, it's appointed by the governor. And there's only two communities in Oregon where that's the case, and Portland is one of them. And that's a part of the reason why we have had some really bad decisions on the part of our port. But I guess my call to Portlanders would be just to become more engaged, like following the port, which is what's happened ever since they tried to build the, Pembina tried to build the propane, liquid propane terminal in Portland about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. It's really changed. The people now do watch the port a lot more closely. I guess another thing that really struck me about being in Tacoma is community space. And I visited 350 Tacoma's little office the last time I was up. And it's a beautiful little spot. And I was talking with a friend down here about how we don't have any space like that, really, that the community can have. I mean, we have these temporary spaces. But I wonder how 350 Tacoma got that space and how communities can find, how organizations can find spaces which can bring in more community events and have just like a much bigger presence in the community.
So 350 actually pays for that space. And so they managed to do that via fundraising. So they have a really good organization and they're doing fundraising and hope to be able to continue cover the rental of that space over the years. I feel like 350 Tacoma has gotten a lot of attention and they're really growing in numbers and they're growing in diversity. It's one of the most diverse environmental groups. And so, and they're extremely inclusive and they express themselves via the arts a lot. And I think that's a really important part because not everybody can be reached with politics or data. Many people respond to art and artful activism. So that's definitely a beautiful part of this entire movement. It's kind of like the glue of everything.
Actually, I heard talking to a friend who's talking about getting those big orcas and salmon built down here in Portland, and we can do this too. And I think people in Portland have been very inspired going up to your demonstrations in Washington and seeing all this amazing art that comes from Backbone and other organizations. So,
right.
So you're an inspiration to us. Well, let you know that.
Well, we look up to one day being Portland.
Well, anyway, Kalani, it's really great to talk with you. We do appreciate all the work that you're doing up there. And I guess one thing we didn't get into is I really also want to hope that people in the whole region really begin to focus on what's going on in Tacoma in the same way that we're starting to focus on what's going on at Jordan Cove. I think that these are region-wide struggles and we really need to work together as a region. So thanks for everything that you're doing.
Thank you for lending our community a voice for far-reaching. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, well, thanks a lot. We've been talking today with Claudia Riedna, who's co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or your family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be talking with Jeffrey Peterson, who's author of A New Coast, Strategies for Responding to Devastating Storms and Rising Seas. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Paul Simon. Thanks for listening and have good holiday season. We'll be back next week to do our final show of 2019 and hope for a better year next year.
City. Long past the midnight curfew, we sat starry-eyed. We were satisfied. And I remember misinformation followed us like a plague. Nobody knew from time to time if the plans were changed. Oh, if the plans were changed.